Welcome to Ring of Fire. I'm Farron Cousins. We've got a phenomenal show coming up for you today. Author, writer, podcaster Cliff Schechter makes his triumphant return to Ring of Fire. He's going to talk to us all about Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And of course, we're going to find out the latest about Donald Trump's legal problems and about those prosecutors resigning in the state of New York. We also have John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine. He's going to be here to tell us how corporations are using the inflation crisis to artificially increase their own prices to line their pockets. And our good friend Chauncey DeVega from Salon.com is going to join us to talk about racism and how Donald Trump may not have created it, but he is certainly given all of these white nationalists here in the United States permission to act in the worst ways possible. You can get the full show every single week. Just go to ROFpodcast.com and sign up. And don't forget, you can catch Ring of Fire every single day of the week on YouTube. Just go to youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. Well, this past week has certainly been one for the record books between Russia invading Ukraine and, of course, Donald Trump suffering four major legal setbacks, but one possible legal, I guess you would say, victory. But either way, joining me right now, one of our all-time favorite folks, a good personal friend of mine, author, writer, podcaster, Cliff Schechter. Cliff, again, it's wonderful to have you back here on Ring of Fire. You know, you and I have known each other for many years. You've been coming on Ring of Fire, I think, since the inception of the show. So it's great to have you back and to finally get to talk to you officially on the record. You and I actually talk all the time, but, you know.
Thank you, first of all, for having me back on. I should go through and watch all the old episodes to kind of see myself gradually age, you know, because I can trace my aging since I started coming on this show. God knows how many years ago, but always a pleasure with you. You're awesome, man. So thank you.
And you know, I'm so sorry to bring you on a week where, you know, there's just no news to talk about, really.
What are we going to talk? I know. We're going to have to come up with something, you know?
In all seriousness, everything is terrible, specifically what is happening right now. It is an invasion by Russia. I know you've got there's plenty of folks on Twitter who don't want to say it's an invasion. And, well, you just don't know the history or, yeah, but the U.S. is also bad. Cut the crap. This is Russia invading a sovereign country. Your thoughts on this, Cliff?
Yes. I'm just kidding. I mean, of course it is, right? I mean, it's so utterly ludicrous. You know, well, there was a time when Ukraine was part of Russia, as part of the Soviet Empire, and you just want to be like, not voluntarily. Do we go all the way back to the Tsarist Empire, give them Finland too? Hey, maybe we give them Alaska back, right? We bought that from them, Seward's Folly. That was once, I mean, no, you know, they did, if let's just put it this way, pick a random country, Denmark. If Denmark suddenly went into Rhode Island and took it over and said, we like this place, there's some Danish people who happen to live here, and then said it was theirs, would we consider that an invasion of our territory? Of course we would. I mean, Putin has no proof. Even if he did have proof, he still would be breaking international law, but he has no proof that anybody there wants him there. There's no data on this or whatever. This is a sovereign nation that is next to him. This is a nation they gave security concerns to when the Soviet Union broke up so that Ukraine would give up its nuclear weapons, that they weren't going to invade. And now, once again, Vladimir Putin has proved himself to be as treacherous a dictator as any who has existed in the history of the world.
And, you know, I've seen a lot of people talk about, well, you got to understand the history of this conflict between Russia and Ukraine to really, you know, because then you understand a little better why what's happening. No, we don't. And then I've seen people, and I'm not naming some of these people because they're little idiot twerps on Twitter that I don't want to give that name recognition to.
They are idiot twerps.
We'll talk about some of the bigger ones too, obviously. But some of these folks say, oh, yeah, well, the U.S. in 2014 got, oh, you mean when Russia invaded Crimea? Yeah, right. That 2014, is that what you're talking about? These people are so stupid, and they have the audacity to say that everybody else is because they don't understand what's... No, we understand what's happening.
Right.
You have a brutal authoritarian dictator in Russia that invaded his neighboring country. And if you try to spin it any other way, you're running interference for Vladimir Putin. That is what is happening right now.
I mean, again, like the whole, you don't know the history. I mean, people forget, you know, Slobodan Milosevic used the war that between the Bosnians and Serbians from the 13th century as a justification for committing genocide. I mean, do we want that? I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of Cherokee that would like Georgia back. We can do that because we were awful in that particular case. And by the way, I can criticize horrendous, awful things the United States has done. I can criticize our going into Iraq as literally breaking international law too. But unlike these people you're talking about, I actually can sort of have two thoughts at the same time, like, and still sit there and say, we've done some terrible things. Vladimir Putin has done nonstop awful things since he came on the scene, really around the early 2000s, even when he stepped down from being president because of their constitution, not allowing two terms in a row, which of course he took care of. He had his puppet Medvedev up there working. He's been running the show now, and we were late to the party in paying attention to this, I admit it. But he's been having journalists killed on even on foreign soil. He invaded Crimea, as you pointed out. He's attacked sovereign regions. He's shot down airplanes filled with civilians. You can go on and on and on. There's no moral equivalency here. You call out wrong when it's wrong. This is evil. And again, this is an invasion of a sovereign nation. History does not matter. Okay. There's no BS about that that gets thrown in here.
And you don't get to throw around the whataboutisms either, you know, just because sure, the U.S. has done some horrible things throughout our history. And you and I, we got no problem calling those things out when they happen, after they happen, before they happen. But that doesn't give anybody else the authority to go out there and say, well, I can bomb this country. I can bomb. I mean, literally, some of the footage we're seeing, children in schoolyards are watching the smoke from the bombings. I mean, that's how close this is. And of course, you know, depending on when people are listening to this or watching this video, you know, there's untold deaths already. You know,
already bombed a few hospitals.
Right.
I mean, at least according to international agencies. So who I think are pretty reputable sources. Yeah.
And so this is horrific. And really, there's only one side to take on this, and that is not Putin's. And I can't believe it is so hard for some of these people out there. And Tulsi Gabbard, another one. Like, how easy is it? I mean, how hard is it, I guess, to just say, hey, Putin's an asshat that should not be doing this? I mean, that's it. That's really like
it's that simple.
The least you could say.
Nothing else matters. Right. Yeah. Again, you brought that up. She said, well, Ukraine isn't really a democracy. Hey, look, man, you're sitting in Florida right now. I'm in Ohio. Are our states really democracies right now? I know that, you know, compared to the percent of our people that vote for things to be liberal in this state or moderate versus what they've done with gerrymandering and everything else. No, no place is a perfect democracy. Ukraine had a democratic election that 73%, I believe, participated in, and they elected their leader, and he is independent, and this other country that has claims on them from the past, from the other times they've invaded this sovereign territory or country in the past, is trying to say that it should still be theirs. It's kind of like the, you know, the backseas rule or something. I don't know. We had you before, we get you again, even though every single time it's been a bloody, vicious, wrong invasion. No. Nope, no, 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 no.
You know, and I, again, can't get over this. And of course, you know, at least as of, you know, the morning after the bombing, suddenly you do see some of the bigger accounts. They've gone silent. Where's Glenn Greenwald? Glenn, we're looking for you on Twitter, buddy. Suddenly you got nothing to say. Where's Matt Taibbi right now? You know, people who at one point did some decent reporting in their history, but now just absolutely banking literally off being contrarians, and then suddenly they get proven so comically wrong that they got nothing to say.
Right. Look, Garry Kasparov, I would encourage people to go read, you know, his obviously dissident famous, you know, to go read his sort of Twitter thread on some of this stuff. And he was pointing out that all of our countries, we have these people that are obviously compromised. I mean, Kevin McCarthy, when he didn't think anybody was listening, said that he was pretty sure Putin was paying both Donald Trump and Dana Rohrabacher, then congressman, who also was a former top aide to Reagan and had access to intelligence and other. I remember saying at that time, do we really think these guys have gone to all this trouble and they're only paying off two people? And, you know, Hillary Clinton, other folks warned us and said that they thought that someone in their own party was being groomed. Who's running for president. And everybody's like, oh my God, how dare you insinuate that about Tulsi Gabbard? We've seen what's happened with Tulsi Gabbard more recently. It's all those people in that universe of Mercer money, Peter Thiel money, you know, the far populist fringe, you know, MAGA right are all in bed with Putin, whether they're in bed with Putin getting paid by him, whether it's just a power play and demagoguery for them and to get ratings, doesn't matter. They don't care that innocent people are being killed. And yeah, I mean, Glenn did disappear. He pops up every once in a while now, you know, to tell us whether we've got six more weeks of winter or whatever. He pops his head out and then he starts tweeting in Portuguese generally, because that's what he does when he's proven wrong, which is pretty much every other day, if not every day.
Well, you know, speaking of being in bed with them, let's not forget Maria Butina and the NRA. I mean, my God, that was a massive, massive story that kind of popped and then disappeared. But no, they had their literal undercover agent sent over here to the United States, infiltrating the NRA, getting these, you know, talks with elected officials and potential candidates. And people are going to sit there and say like, oh, no, there's you're crazy for pushing this. I mean, it literally happened.
She was dating a Republican consultant who had access to private polling material. I mean, you don't need to speculate here. These are things that happened. We know that, you know, Paul Manafort sat down with Konstantin Kilmenik, oligarch, top Putin guy, handed him the polling during the election. That happened. That's known as collusion. People can say, ooh, no collusion. Broke up the word collusion. They colluded. And again, there's so many examples of this. It's depressing at times. Former, you know, prime minister of Germany, Gerhard Schroeder, who's been mouthing anything Putin wants him to must apparently be, you know, on the payroll. There's journalists across the Western world. There's fringe far right and far left characters. It's all about attacking that center where we all agree, where democracy lives and breathes, right? Where we can come to consensus and have elections, accept the results without violence. That is what he's been attacking throughout the West. And the trail is clear. Like, we know he loaned money to Le Pen in the far right nationalist party in France. The bank statements were there. We know that he was supporting Leave and putting resources behind that to weaken the EU, because it's these post-World War II institutions created exactly to stop a Hitler type character again, that have gotten in his way from doing what he thinks he should be able to do, which he said out loud, which is putting back the old empire back together. It's NATO, it's the EU, World Bank, all these types of organizations. And so he wants to destroy them all. And that's why he helped Trump win. And that's why, you know, he pushed Leave. And that's why he's helped Orban and Hungary and Duda and Poland and others to undermine NATO. I mean, again, this is a long game he's been playing here. And we're seeing the results. I'll say one more thing quickly, which is, you know, you've got these right wingers, the usual, you know, Hugh Hewitt. I sometimes wonder when I watch Hugh Hewitt if he's going to just start molting on TV. He looks so much like a lizard. But OK, we'll move on from that. You know, we're like, well, you know, we haven't nobody invaded while Trump was in office, because they didn't need to. Because they had Lavrov in the Oval Office with Trump giving him national security secrets and undermining operations against, you know, ISIS. Because we had Trump's people sharing all sorts of information. We had private conversations with Trump and Putin where they kicked the translators out. We still don't even know what was said. The whole point is that he installed, you know, Trump to weaken NATO to the point where he could do this. Why was he going to attack while Trump was successfully undermining us? It made sense to attack when the people who fight back against him are in office. This is pretty simple stuff.
It really is. And, you know, I do want to switch gears here for a minute because, start talking about Trump. So let's talk about Trump, right? Okay.
One tyrant to another, sure.
in the last, was it probably 13 days? Okay. Four major, legal, I guess you would call them, defeats for Donald Trump. First, he gets dumped by Mazars. As the Mazars news is breaking, the judge in D.C. says that the Trump kids are getting added back into the lawsuit. Then, of course, later in the week, you got the judge in New York that says, hey, guess what? You all have to go and sit down with the investigators. And then, of course, the Supreme Court telling Donald Trump officially, you don't get executive privilege anymore. So
on an 8-1 decision, make clear. He's got six right wingers on there. I'm guessing Clarence Thomas was the one who went along with him, because let's be honest. But he's got six right wingers, and he can only manage 16% of the right wing nut caucus in the Supreme Court to side with him on that. So
you got four very big developing stories that even I try to remain skeptical and not get optimistic. But even after seeing all that, I was like, oh man. Things are moving forward fast. And then, of course, Wednesday afternoon, the bomb drops, not just in Ukraine, but it dropped from the prosecutors in New York, who abruptly resigned because apparently Alvin Bragg, the new DA, they don't think he's taking this seriously and pretty much acting like he doesn't want this thing to go any further. They haven't interviewed anybody in front of the grand jury in over a month, and they say he's stalled us out, basically. To distill what they said, he's stalled us out with this investigation. Right. So that's a pretty horrible development after pretty much a week of great news. Maybe there's accountability, only to find that, oh wow, this big investigation has effectively crapped out.
Yeah, I don't know what he thinks he's doing, and again, this stuff should be done because it's right. It should be done because we believe in the rule of law, because we believe in our constitution, we believe in democracy and fair play and all of this. Sadly, there are a lot of other reasons things happen in the real world. Sometimes the right things happen for the wrong reasons. And I would have thought Bragg wanting to keep support from New York City, from Democrats, from whoever in the city is overwhelming Democratic, would realize that that's his political obituary if he does that. Apparently, he's too stupid to get that. Luckily, we've been watching the Attorney General in New York, who we know has higher aspirations to run for governor and other things, who has been on this, aggressive, out there talking, all the stuff that I wish Merrick Garland were doing more of. She's been out there and doing this. And the truth is, again, any one of these investigations can destroy the Trump family and put them away for life. Yeah. And so the fact that we have Letitia James, at least, I don't know what the hell's wrong with Alvin Bragg. We should be calling him out constantly and making sure that he's replaced as soon as possible. But I will say the reason why I've never felt fully confident in Merrick Garland either, what I felt confident in is the New York AG's office. And so that is where I'm still kind of, and a little side one, that investigation going on in Atlanta and Fulton County, that also seems to be an aggressive one, and one where again, Democrats by parochial politics, you want to win a Democratic primary, letting Trump off the hook is not a good way to do that. Making sure you're a hero in a Democratic primary would be prosecuting Donald Trump. And so again, I want it to happen for the right reasons, and I'd like to believe that Letitia James is doing it for the right reasons also, but even if she's doing it for the wrong reasons, to make sure that she's she cannot be defeated in a primary for governor in 4 years, fine. I'll take whatever I can get at this point. So I'm pissed at Bragg, but I still do think we've got a great chance at justice. I don't let myself get over confident just the way you said you don't. And I think that because of the fact that she's sitting there in the AG's office.
Well, and it's hard to not. Yeah, I know. Look, everybody's innocent until proven guilty, right? But Mazars came out, or the news of Mazars came out last week, where they said, listen, everything he's given us for at least the last 10 years is bullshit.
I know. They're like, I mean, we will no longer put our reputation behind what he handed us.
So it's very difficult to think that, okay, if you're investigating for bank fraud and tax fraud, the group that is preparing his financial statement says, yeah, these are not reliable. That's their words, not reliable. I mean, that's
the work of Letitia James again.
Yeah, and that's
her work that got that to happen. So, yeah.
I mean, to me, that's Mazar saying, okay, well, here's the smoking gun with all the fingerprints on it. And then to find out the New York, you know, the Manhattan, I guess, DA is like, nah. I mean, at least, you know, thank God we still have Letitia James out there, because if not, this would be probably the most depressing week of news ever.
If we didn't have her there. And again, I don't know what Alvin Bragg thinks he's doing. He better figure it out soon, because I will devote all time and energy to making sure that he is gone and never. And I don't think I have to. I don't think any of us have to. I think his name will become synonymous with Benedict Arnold, you know, in New York. And he can take a hike. Maybe he can move to a red state and run there.
Well, and I want people to understand, too, like, look, obviously, you and I both are in agreement. We would love to see Donald Trump, the Trump kids, maybe not Barron and Tiffany, I guess. They're probably okay for now.
Not Barron. Tiffany went and spoke at some things. I've lost all sympathy for her. She threw him behind him, and she was old enough to know better. So but that's me.
But, you know, it's not just because, we got you. We want you behind bars. When you look at Trump's response to Putin's invasion of Ukraine, you know, not only calling him a genius, it's so savvy, but then actually suggesting that we do that on the southern border, Trump needs to go away, because if he gets back into that White House, which is unfortunately a real possibility, this country becomes unrecognizable. We become Russia in 2024 if Donald Trump wins again. And that is why these things are so important, because unfortunately, he has a big following in this country, because people love authoritarianism. So we have to stop him by way of these investigations, by making it to where you can't run again, because you're not going to hold a campaign rally from federal prison. And that's what's really at the heart of all of this.
Yeah, I'm not going to pretend for a second that I won't, you know, get a sense of schadenfreude from these evil pieces of dung who have hurt so many people going and being, you know, put behind bars. But that, again, that is not the biggest reason to be for this. There's not the biggest reason I am. The biggest reason I'm for this is because all this stuff these right-wingers mouth, you know, that they never actually mean, I do mean, which is I do believe in my country. I do believe we've made some horrible mistakes along the way, and yet we've been a country that at least, you know, we've taken some steps backward, but we've always ended up moving forward and still been the longest democracy that's been the freest for the most number of people and given opportunities to immigrants from across the world. Like my family, my grandfather came here in 1906 from Kiev. Guess what? So, you know, as a 6-month-old baby, and here I'm sitting, you know. And so, I do believe in all this. I do believe in our Constitution, but also improving it. I do believe in. And so because I believe in that, he has to go to prison, and they have to, because without the rule of law, I'm sorry, I was an Obama supporter, but when, you know, and I know he had a financial crisis and all this, but when he chose not to look back at the torture and some of the other things, what that meant was people knew they could now get away with these things. And if Trump and his, not just family, that whole universe of suck ups around him, people that have broken the law, people that have attacked our system, undermined democracy, if they do not pay a price, a noticeable, painful price that all of us can see in this country, then we're going to be in serious trouble, because then they're going to walk around and they're going to skip around and, whoa, see, it wasn't a big deal what I did. And they're going to have our lack of action to prove that. And then you're right. You know, because if he were president right now, he just went on Fox and Friends or whatever this morning and didn't attack Vladimir Putin. He attacked Joe Biden. I mean, if he were president right now, he would be taking Putin's side, which is always why Putin wanted to install it. And we will become an unrecognizable, just another autocratic, illiberal democracy that has elections, but basically they don't mean anything. And the same people win all the time.
Well, and, you know, when you look back at all of his praise that he had during his time as president, the praise for Putin, the praise for Kim Jong-il, you know,
Erdogan in Turkey and,
right,
and Bolsonaro in Brazil.
I mean, the list is endless. You know, the Saudi royal family committing all these atrocities.
Duterte killing, you know, people in the streets of the Philippines. He's a despot. It is in his heart, and you know, he wants to be one of them. He wants to be in that club.
And I've said this plenty of times here on Ring of Fire, and it's because I truly believe this. watching how he reacted to losing and still finding out more and more each week, basically, about their efforts to overthrow that election or use the military to seize the voting machines. If he wins office again, he's never leaving. He won't be limited by the Constitution. They'll do what they can. And then we end up with, you know, president for life. This is so dire. And I hate, you know, sounding that way, but it really, we're seeing so much more behavior that we didn't even know existed, that this is terrifying. And again, if he gets in office, I'm saying it right now, he won't leave until they take him out of there on a stretcher.
Correct. I mean, look, all of us who were called, you know, those of us anyhow who are called the hysterical ones. Oh, yeah, sure, the Supreme Court matters. I mean, come on, they're never going to allow abortion to be banned. Go to Texas. You know, I mean, those of us who along the way get called hysterical, I hate to say it, like, we're right about everything. Like, I don't choose to just get overwrought and upset about things that I don't think can happen. But do I think if he wins in 2024, he's right away a full-blown dictator? No. But what he'll do is he'll do what he did from 2017 to 2021 when he was in office, which is systematically undermine the civil service and fill our you know, non-political slots with political cronies, systematically undermine watchdog attempts to make sure government money doesn't disappear, align himself with the world's worst autocrats, try to do things to harm vulnerable populations just because he seems to kind of get off on it because he's an evil piece of, I don't know if I'm allowed to say that on here, so I won't. You know, like he, you know, we watched all of this. And so some of those things he started to do, but didn't finish. Some of them he finished, and we're now at a point where traditions that used to exist, you know, don't no longer exist. You know, like we can assume any attorney general he puts in will have fealty 100% to him from the beginning, and the Republicans will vote for that person if they control the Senate, and there's nothing we can do about it. It will no longer be an attorney general of the United States. It'll be his personal lawyer. Like, he broke that part of our system, you know, just to name one of many, and he will finish that. So he gets an office in 2024. I would agree with you. He's not leaving. And I would say that I wouldn't be surprised if we're a full-blown dictatorship by 2030 at that point.
And a lot of it is because, you know, trial and error. Right. He knows where he went wrong the first time. Oh, I didn't have an attorney general that would overturn an election. I didn't have enough state attorney generals loyal to me that would overturn their states. And so they are, you know, we see it every day. The systematically, I'm pushing this person for attorney general in this swing state. I'm pushing
and secretaries
this one over
of
here.
State count the votes.
And, yeah. I mean, and so they're laying the groundwork for everything we're saying. And, you know, people can ignore it or say we're being alarmist at their own peril, but we're watching it unfold right now across the United States.
People like them, when they have the ability to use power, they don't just say, yeah, I know that we kicked all these people off the voting rolls, and I know that we took partisan control of the vote counting. Yeah, but we're just not going to use it. I mean, that doesn't happen. And you know it doesn't happen because you're sitting in a state run by just about the worst governor in the country. He's in a competition with Abbott, I think, for who's the biggest, most evil, again, words I won't say on here. But, you know, we know what these guys are about. We know what they're going to do. And so, you know, they succeeded at some of it the first time, but now they've laid the groundwork for a lot more of it. And like they've already probably put cronies in certain places who are still there, little crevices of our government you don't even know about. They've got people there. You know what I mean? And so we can expect all of this stuff again from him if he's able to win. Or, frankly, if it's not him and it's a DeSantis who will take full advantage of all of that, or an Abbott or another one of these ghouls like that. So, I mean, the whole point is like we need this to become as considered as gross and disgusting being a Trump, MAGA, Putin supporter as it is. We need it to become as gauche and unpopular so that these people cannot win in most places, except for, you know, a couple of districts in Congress that we can't help. And we need to try to at least have a functioning sort of multi-party system where most people fall within the boundaries of sort of acceptable non-authoritarianism. And we can move towards that in some ways, if we can hold on to the House and the Senate in 22, if we can win in 24, we start losing these things to these guys. They are going to consolidate all the power they can while they're there.
Absolutely. Look, Cliff Schechter, co-host of the Unprecedented podcast, Your writing appears all over the place, a lot of times in the Daily Beast, and of course, a beloved friend of us here at Ring of Fire, author of The Real McCain as well. Still definitely should check that out. So, Cliff,
you can find me at Cliff Schechter on Twitter, and then I'll point you in all sorts of directions.
That is great. Cliff, thank you so much for joining us today on Ring of Fire.
Always my pleasure, Farron. Seriously, thanks for having me, buddy.
Inflation concerns basically impact everybody in the United States right now. Some of us are obviously concerned about the fact that we can't afford what we could afford just a year ago, but others are concerned that maybe their profits aren't benefiting enough from this crisis. And joining me now to talk about what is happening is author, Nation Magazine correspondent, John Nichols. John, lovely to have you back on Ring of Fire. Obviously, over the years, you've been one of our go-to people because you're just always on top of everything. So thank you for joining me again today.
It's an honor to be with you, as always, in these challenging times.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, you know, so many things happening in the world this week. But I want to talk because, one, you've got a great new book out. But two, you had a wonderful article come out of The Nation this week where you talked about these essentially these inflation profiteers, I guess we could call them. Because, yes, we've got horrible inflation right now, but this problem is being capitalized upon by these major corporations that use this as an excuse to just ramp up their prices for no other reason than just pure unadulterated greed, right?
That's exactly right. And I think the best way to understand inflation is that it's complicated. It always is. And so if somebody says, oh, I've got a simple answer for you for why this is occurring, pause and step back. There's going to be more to it. And as I write about in the book, look, there are supply chain challenges that go back to the Trump administration. And when Donald Trump put Jared Kushner in charge of the supply chain as regards COVID supplies, that was disastrous. And so you can point fingers of blame there. That's appropriate. You can also, look at the reality of we've just been through an incredibly traumatic moment with the pandemic. We've got huge new challenges coming as regards Russia, Ukraine, all the international issues. So we keep piling it up. But one of the important things to do is to pause in the midst of that and not get lost. Don't accept so many complex explanations that we miss the one core reality. And that is we have a lot of inflation right now. We're up prices up around 7.5% from January 2021 to January 2022. And at the same time, we have record corporate profits. And again, what we see is multinational corporations announcing record profits and on the same day announcing that they're raising their prices. So this is something to understand. They are not raising their prices to get by. They are not raising their prices to deal with increased costs per se. Many of these companies making record profits are increasing their prices because they have a monopoly situation. They're in a circumstance where they can increase those prices, and they're doing it at tremendous cost to working class Americans and, frankly, to the economy itself.
And, the beauty of this for a CEO, right, and they're actually on the record admitting that they do this. When you have, this such rapid inflation like what we see right now, prices obviously go up astronomically. So they tack on their additional increases that go straight into, the corporate pockets. So that way, when inflation slows, prices do drop a little bit, but they're not going to hit back to that original point. But people will be happy that the prices have gone down a little bit, not realizing that it would go down even more had it not been for the artificial inflation placed upon it by the corporation. So it's a win-win for them because people are, oh, good, milk is, $3.50 instead of $4 a gallon. Well, really, it ought to be like $3.25. You're still paying that extra quarter that you weren't paying a year ago, but you've already forgotten that, and that extra quarter is just going into somebody's pocket.
I think that's exactly right. And then let's put one other element into the mix here, which is, I think, really important. Again, something I've been looking at a lot, both in the book and in a lot of recent articles, is that during the pandemic, it was an emergency situation. It still is, by the way. I'm not in the camp that says the pandemic is done. I think we have lingering challenges, and we're just one variant away from, you know, finding ourselves back in some pretty difficult circumstances. And so, but as the pandemic was at its peak, a lot of us learned that you're just going to have to spend what it costs to do things, right? It wasn't that people were spending wildly. It was that people, you know, recognized that it was just more difficult. Things were more complicated. Some prices did go up a lot. People started to pay for delivery of things that they in the past would have gone and picked up themselves, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so what's happening now is that a lot of the corporations, rather than saying, you know, if the pandemic does ease as we move out of this, obviously costs are going to go down. They're not saying that at all. What they're saying is, oh, what we figured out was that we can get people to pay a lot more for things that they need for essentials. And so what we're seeing, Perrin, is that the big companies that deal in basics like Kellogg's, with cereal, or the companies that deal in, you know, home care products and such things, they're actually spiking their prices right now to take advantage of this moment. And it is it kind of blurs the line between a pandemic profiteering, which you saw a good deal of, and a kind of traditional inflation profiteering. But the end result is that Americans are ending up paying a lot more. And this is a very dangerous game politically, because while people are paying these increased prices, they feel it and they're upset about it. They don't like it. And at this point, this creates a huge opening for the Republicans, because all they have to say is, you don't like how things are. You feel uncomfortable. You feel kind of strained and stressed economically. Well, Biden's president, and the Democrats control the Congress. Why don't you change that? I mean, for them, their message becomes very, very simple. And the Democrats had better be prepared to respond to that and better be prepared to write a different narrative, or this inflation challenge is going to become a very big burden for Democrats as they head toward the midterms.
Right. And part of that problem, too, is obviously Republicans want to paint the picture that, hey, you know, these Democrats, they're not doing anything about inflation. And as you said earlier, it's an exceptionally complicated issue. I mean, so many different factors, you know, this is, you know, several college courses worth of understanding how inflation even works. But some people, I mean, honestly, there's some people who think that, well, Congress could just stop inflation. Biden could just stop it. No, it's absolutely not that simple. Don't you think anybody would if they could? But when Republicans capture that narrative, they do distill it down to inflation bad, you lose money, Biden does nothing. And unfortunately, it's a winning message. And it is exceptionally difficult to counter that, right? There's no truth to it. But still, I mean, I don't even know how you craft a message, you know, that is capable of undoing that damage. You know, when bad things happen, it does fall on the president. And, you know, whether it's fair or not is irrelevant. The public is, because of these Republican talking points, believe it. So they really are between a rock and a hard place on this issue.
Up to a point. But here's where it gets interesting. You're absolutely right that the Republicans basically at this point don't have to do anything. They could literally just stand there and, you know, reap the benefits of people being upset about inflation. Right. You know, and remember, if inflation went up 7.5% from January 2021 to January 2022, if that rate continues, and with what's happened with Russia, Ukraine, a host of other factors, that there is a real likelihood that it does continue, that it could even accelerate. Let's imagine that prices are 15% higher by November. That, you know, if you go from January 2021 to November 2022, that you've had a 15% price increase in under 2 years. Everybody's going to feel that. Everybody's going to be upset. In that circumstance, the Republicans don't have to say a thing. They benefit just by being not in power. Okay, but the Democrats are not without options here, and this is the big deal. What Democrats have to do is to talk about price gouging, to talk about what the corporations are doing, to identify the profiteering and the abuses, and to make a big deal of that. They should be investigating it at the congressional level. Biden should be cracking down on it with executive orders and other initiatives There should be legislative proposals. They should make a big deal about this. And because that then shifts the narrative, it creates an alternative way of thinking about what's going on. It happens to be an accurate alternative. This is not, you know, just some spin. There's real truth here that they can work with, but they have to put that out and they have to talk about it. And as an example in the piece, and also somewhat in the book, I write about some of these issues. Franklin Roosevelt during the Great Depression, people assume, you know, Roosevelt comes in, he does the New Deal and everything gets great. That wasn't the case at all. The New Deal was slow to take. It took a lot of time, and the Depression lingered as a painful reality in the mid-1930s. And what did Roosevelt do? Well, he said, look, we are trying to help. We're doing everything we can. But you need to understand that there are bankers and financial institutions and businesses that are still profiteering, that are still trying to come out ahead as a result of an economic crisis, and that their abuses are harming you. Roosevelt made that especially clear. He even said in a 1936 speech, talked about the bankers and his critics and said, I welcome their hatred. He made a clear line of division between his administration and the business interests that were taking advantage of the Great Depression moment. Biden and the Democrats need to do something very similar to that. They need to talk about inflation as something that does extend in many ways from the abuses by multinational corporations. If they do so, then they create a counter narrative to, you know, whatever the Republicans are putting out there, and it makes it a much, much more realistic fight. It also creates the possibility that Democrats could say, look, you know, we have very narrow majorities. Give us some real authority and we can tackle this. That's an affirmative message that you take into an election campaign. But I talk about all this, you know, as this is theoretical, because the fact is the Democrats aren't doing it. Very few Democrats are doing it. Bernie Sanders is, Elizabeth Warren, handful of others. But by and large, Democrats are failing to talk about inflation in the kind of serious and aggressive ways that they should.
You know, it is. I just have to mention this as an aside, because it is funny how you mentioned, you know, well, yes, Bernie is talking about this. And yes, Elizabeth Warren is talking about this. You know, there's so many issues that I've even talked about and said nobody's talking about this. Well, except for, of course, Bernie and Elizabeth Warren. It always seems those two really have their fingers on the pulse and understand in a way that others refuse to understand. It's not that they don't get it. It's that they're refusing to really address it. So it is nice, you know, that we do have those, and again, several others too, that are the fighters up there. But we need to bolster their ranks, right? We need a young generation of, especially in the Senate, you know, we've got a nice growing chorus in the House. The Senate, though, is very weak on that kind of progressive side. You know, with, you've got Bernie, you've got Elizabeth Warren, you know, Merkley.
Yeah, you Merkley. You can point to a group of them. Actually, interestingly, Ron Wyden has really stepped up more and more in recent years. And so I think there are some who are there and on different issues, etc. But this is the interesting thing. We're not just talking, and I know you know this, Farron. We're not just talking about being right on the issues, about, you know, understanding what's going on here. We're talking about being capable of stepping up and addressing those issues in a intense debate, in a very difficult time, and potentially turning the center of gravity, turning the nature of the discourse in a direction that makes it possible for people to have a better understanding of what's at stake politically. And in situations like that, you can point to Bernie and to Elizabeth Warren, to members of the squad in the House, to candidates like Nina Turner. You can point to people around the country who are talking about inflation in really smart, really engaged ways. But some of this has to come from the White House. I mean, this is a very difficult situation, because Joe Biden has, and I'll give him credit, I think he has tried to do a lot of good things. He's done some very good things. But right now, with the Russia-Ukraine crisis, Biden's public face is going to be primarily a foreign policy public face, at least for a good period of time. And it's his job. It's understandable. But that doesn't shift the narrative as regards inflation at home. And the Biden administration, people in it, have to understand that while they deal with all of the other issues that they're dealing with, they've got to start talking about this in much deeper, much more fundamental ways, as Roosevelt did. Again, we use the example of Roosevelt. Roosevelt was dealing with incredibly overwhelming international issues in his time. I mean, you're literally dealing with the rise of fascism. And yet he kept a very firm focus on communicating with the American people about economics at home. He didn't lose sight of that. And I think that that was one of the reasons why he proved to be such a popular president, and also why in his midterm elections, in especially the 1934 midterm, he actually increased his majority, right? He didn't fall back. He did better. And I think that level of focused, serious communication about economics from the White House and from the top of the Democratic Party becomes very, very important in this year. If they don't do it, I think they run the risk of, being, in many cases, quite noble people trying to do some decent things, but not getting any traction.
You know, and when we talk about this inflation issue, too, and the supply chain that goes along with it, another kind of X factor here is we've lost 925,000 plus American lives in the last 2 years. That is a massive part of our workforce throughout the United States. And so there's a way to also spread that message too. And it should be one of, listen, first and foremost, protect yourselves. The masks are not hurting you. Please, wear the mask, get vaccinated. We're losing so many lives. People are losing their family members, their friends, and their coworkers. And then also you have to almost, I guess, dehumanize it and say, this is also a supply chain problem. And I know that sounds weird. You never want to dehumanize with these issues, but there has to be a better way. Somebody much smarter than I am could communicate that effectively to say, listen, if we can protect ourselves and we can pull out of this pandemic, we can prevent all of this death that is also directly affecting this economic issue that we're facing at the same time. Again, I'm clearly not the guy to make that message, but it's something that does have to factor in when we talk about the supply chain issues. That's almost a million people. It will be a million people within a few months, I fear.
Oh, it will be. That's a tragic reality. And let's also be clear that millions more have, because of the impact of the pandemic, decided that they're done working. We have a huge level of retirement at earlier than expected ages, and all sorts of people really readjusting their lives. So all of this has a profound impact. And we also have a situation where people are demanding, where they are working, they're demanding fairer pay and safer workplaces, as they should.
Yeah, it's
because
great.
In the pandemic, we saw, some really difficult times. So all of this becomes a part of it. And I guess, Farron, actually, you say, oh, I'm not the guy to sort this out. In many ways, you are sorting it out exactly right, because you are bringing the pandemic into this. And what we ought to do is have more complicated discussions, not simpler ones. And that's what a president can do. That's what, political leaders can at their best do. And here's the bottom line. During the pandemic, we had a massive redistribution of the wealth upwards. In the book I write about, the billionaires started the pandemic in the United States, controlling about $3 trillion. 18 months into the pandemic, they controlled $5 trillion. That's one of the most massive redistributions of the wealth upward in history. At the same time, pharmaceutical companies have made unimaginable, jaw-dropping profits. Now, we're glad that we got the vaccine. I'm double vaccinated. I'm boosted. I want to get the next booster if we need it. But we have to understand that a lot of corporations cashed in a huge way economically during this time. And people see that. They know that. And so as we talk about inflation, we should also talk about pandemic profiteering. We should talk about the fact that during the pandemic, we had people who made a lot of money and did not join in the shared sacrifice that was expected of everybody else. If we begin to understand it in that way and talk about it in that way, then we start to make the distinctions that make sense to people, right? And if you put inflation in that context, which you should, then we start to say, okay, well, this looks like a much more serious line of abuses than we knew. It isn't just a natural disaster. What we understand is Donald Trump put Jared Kushner in charge of the supply chain for pandemic supplies, for health supplies and things like that at a critical stage. And he screwed it up horribly. The Trump administration screwed up horribly on all sorts of interventions as regards public health, but also as regards the supply chain. And so the Biden administration inherited that, much as Roosevelt inherited the failures of the Hoover administration. Biden and his aides shouldn't be uncomfortable talking about that. They should make it clear. They inherited a disaster, and it has been very, very hard to right the course. And then at the same time, they should talk about the lingering reality that corporations are cashing in on this moment and are announcing record profits, and in the next breath, announcing that they're raising prices. Put things into that kind of perspective, and suddenly a lot of these debates become very, very different. Instead of, you know, having a division between people who want a vaccination and people who don't, which is absurd, everybody should get vaccinated, then we have a much clearer discussion about people who profited off this moment and people who were left behind. And the fact is that if we start to get into that perspective, if we start to get clarity on that, then people can get angry at the right subjects of their anger. They can be angry at the billionaires who increase their wealth exponentially. They can be angry at pharmaceutical companies that are cashing in at excess profit levels. They can be angry at the politicians who let them down, many of whom are still lingering and running for office this year, people like Ron Johnson in Wisconsin and, you know, Rand Paul in Kentucky. So this is the way to kind of expand the discussion out. But if Democrats don't do that, if they don't get a grip on the discussion about COVID, and if they don't get a grip on the discussion about inflation, they run the very real risk of having the Republicans write the narrative of this year. And in a midterm election cycle, the party that writes the narrative tends to win.
And that is, you know, a very terrifying thought, too. And what I would like to see is the Democrats craft this message in a way that gets people angry at these corporate profiteers the same way they got angry at the people selling, you know, packs of toilet paper for $50, you know, selling bottles of hand sanitizer for $10. Yes, those were horrible people. But just because a corporation does it doesn't mean they're not as equally as despicable as what those, you know, little profiteers, I'm going to sell this on Amazon, I'm going to become a, you know, millionaire overnight because I bought all the hand sanitizer in my city. Look, the corporations, they may not be doing it to that scale. They may not seem as menacingly evil as those people were. But at the end of the day, it's the same thing, just to a different degree and on a much larger scale. So the anger we felt at those profiteers, we've got to redirect that to these massive corporations. And that's the message they got to be running with.
You're exactly right. And if I can just add one exclamation mark to that and say that look, during the pandemic, a lot of things were up for grabs. People were trying desperately to come up with solutions. Sometimes they succeeded, sometimes they failed. I don't blame people for making mistakes. What I get mad about and what I write about is people who understood what the stakes were, understood what was in play, and chose to do the wrong thing, chose to profiteer. Now, the person on the street corner selling the hand sanitizer, yeah, I'm a little angry with them. That's, you know, that is what it is. But of course, I am much angrier and should be much angrier with the CEO of the multinational corporation that jacks up prices while making record profits because they can get away with it. They know the harm that they are doing. The same with the billionaire, right? The billionaires who, you know, reaped unimaginable increases in their wealth. Well, you know, on the surface, you say, well, they just got lucky. No, they didn't just get lucky. At Amazon, they fired whistleblowers who said that these warehouses are unsafe. They prevented a union from organizing. They didn't reap their profits simply by being there and having it happen. They reaped their profits by taking advantage of very difficult situations and often, doing the wrong thing. And now, again, in a difficult situation with inflation and with a lingering pandemic, you see profiteers jacking up prices. That's wrong. That isn't what they should be doing. They should be held to account. And in a political context, saying that, being very blunt about that, is an incredibly powerful political message. It works. Tax the profiteers is a good message. Regulate the profiteers. Crack down on the profiteers. Arrest the profiteers. Those are powerful messages, and they will become more powerful if inflation increases.
John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation. The new book is Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers, Accountability for Those Who Caused the Crisis. John, throughout all the years of Ring of Fire, it is always a pleasure to talk to you. I definitely want to have you back on as much as you're willing to do it. So thank you again for talking with us today.
Very honored to join you, brother. It's a good conversation. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. That's it for this week's free Ring of Fire show. Coming up on the members only show, blogger, author, podcaster Chauncey DeVega will be here with me to talk about the looming race war that Donald Trump supporters so desperately want. And if you want access to that interview, as well as the entirety of the Ring of Fire podcast archives, go sign up and become a member at rofpodcast.com.